positioned his blade just below the body armor and above the pelvis, stabbing it in and ratcheting it back and forth to create a massive wound channel in the man's guts. In the violence that is hand-to-hand combat, seconds seem like minutes and minutes seem like hours. Only 5 seconds had elapsed since Reese had connected with the man whose life he was now extinguishing. Even with the blood draining from his body, Reese's opponent fought on. Just like countless men over the centuries, he didn't yet know he was dead. Reese felt the man's hands flailing, reaching in adrenaline-fueled desperation for the grenade Reese wore on the left side of his armor. Moving immediately back to the mount, ripping his grenade from the dying man's grasp, Reese sank the blade into his opponent's left eye before cutting down across the man's face to the back of his head toward the mandible. He worked his own left arm around the back of the enemy's head where it met his other hand holding the blade. Reese's face was pressed against the side of his opponent's head as he worked the blade deeper and deeper into his brain stem until the thrashing body went limp. Reese held the deadly embrace for a moment before disengaging the knife and sliding off the corpse beneath him. Situational awareness, Reese. Breathing heavily, Reese straightened his helmet and pushed himself back against the building that had minutes before been his sanctuary, scanning the compound before him as the discipline of his years of training took over. Resheathing the blade that had just saved his life, Reese caught a glimpse of the inscription. Interrupted by blood, bile, and sticky white slivers of bone and brain were the words, "Pamwichete." The gift from Rich Hastings had taken another soul. Smoothly bringing his MP7 up into his workspace, Reese pulled a magazine from his armor and performed a tactical reload, retaining the partially spent one for later use. Without pockets to stow the magazine, he shoved it into the empty radio pouch on his rig. Seeing no sign of movement in his immediate vicinity, he knelt at the side of the man he had just killed and removed his helmet. The man's face was a bloody mess, but something about it seemed vaguely familiar. Do I know him? He wore desert boots, a chest rig over his body armor, and an older Kevlar helmet, but what really interested Reese were his NODs and uniform. PVS-15s meant one thing, they were U.S.-backed. The Desert Tiger Stripe uniforms meant something else. CIA. Later, Reese, make sense of this later. Win the fight. Prioritize and execute. Where is the nearest threat? Taking a wide angle, Reese moved around the side of the house. He was doing the most natural thing a man could do. He was hunting. After the grenade blast, the firing coming from the back of the building had stopped, which meant that the shooter could be on the move. Reese crept quietly but quickly down the 10-foot-wide alley between the side of the house and the perimeter wall where there was no cover. He needed to get through the lethal funnel as fast as he could. He could still hear the pitched battle at the back of the compound, where things sounded like they had reached a stalemate. As he approached the back of the house, Reese had the strong urge to toss a grenade around the corner, but, not knowing the location of the other friendlies, he held back. He eased around, step by step, and saw the bright streak of Freddy's IR laser coming from the upstairs window. Knowing the yard was covered, Reese rounded the corner to clear the area close to the house that would be below his partner's line of sight. Expecting to find his target directly behind the building, Reese was surprised when he saw no sign of movement. Assuming that the man had moved around the opposite side of the house, Reese checked back the way he had come to ensure that he wasn't being outmaneuvered. Nothing. Where did he go? Then he heard it, a scraping sound above him. He looked up to find a man just 10 feet away scaling the side of the building using a water pipe as a ladder, with his weapon slung at his side. Ordinarily, he would have seen him when he rounded the corner, but the narrow, vertical view through his NODs prevented it. The climber was obviously planning to shoot through the window above to take out the SEAL sniper, who was firing from a few feet back in the room. Freddy would never see it coming. Reese calmly put his IR laser on the figure's backside and gave him a long burst. He could hear the hollow sound of the tiny suppressed rounds impacting flesh and a quiet yelp of pain. The impact of the body hitting the hard ground was louder than either, and Reese put two rounds into his head for good measure. Knowing the enemy had a similar technological advantage of NODs, he resisted the urge to make a circling motion in front of the window with his laser to let his partner know of his position.
"Freddy,"
Reese whispered as loudly as he dared.
"Freddy!"
"Reese, that you?"
came the response.
"Yeah, I'm down here."
"You okay?"
"I'm good. These guys have NODs.
"I know, what the hell?"
"I'm going to go help the boys out back."
"Roger that, I'm coming down."
A minute later the back door opened and Freddy, dressed identically to Reese except that he was wearing pants, emerged, carrying his HK-416.
"Do you sleep in that gear?"
Reese asked his buddy, half in jest.
"Says a guy with no pants. Hey, you recognize the uniforms?"
Freddy asked.
"You know I do.
Let's get this done and then figure it out. Try to take one alive to question."
"Hey, are you shot?"
Freddy asked, reaching toward his friend.
"No, I'm good. It's not my blood."
"Roger that."
"Sounds like they breached the wall in two places with VBIEDs,
Reese said.
"Yeah, I've taken out about a dozen guys back here. You?"
"Four dead guys out front and Spider-Man here who was coming to get you."
Freddy looked down at the body and then looked up at the water pipe, putting two and two together.
"Shit.
Thanks, bro."
"My pleasure.
Let's move down the left side here, circle behind the barn, and see if we can get behind them. I couldn't see them from upstairs, but I could hear them. Let's do it."
No further conversation was needed as they moved toward the gunfight. Freddy led the way since he had the more capable weapon in the open space of the compound. The little MP7 was great at close range, but Reese suddenly felt way undergunned in the open area between the buildings. They maintained laser discipline, knowing the lasers would be visible through the enemy's NODs. Luckily for them, the enemy was not as disciplined. As they approached the large storage barn, they could see infrared beams darting around the courtyard. Freddy motioned upward, indicating that he would look for an elevated position. Reese gave him an exaggerated nod and continued along the backside of the building to flank their aggressors. Even though suppressed, the firing became louder as Reese approached the corner of the building. Suppressed meant just that, suppressed, not silent. Reese worked his way around the corner and found six men 25 yards from his position, all facing away from him, using one of the compound's vehicles for cover as they fired toward the redacted building. He ducked back behind the barn and pulled the fragmentation grenade from his kit, removing the electrician's tape from the pull ring. He held the spoon between the web of his right-hand thumb and pointer finger, then yanked the pull ring clear of the device and tossed the baseball-sized bomb around the corner toward the cluster of combatants. The explosion was followed immediately by screams. Reese took a knee and methodically pumped rounds into the heads of each of the writhing bodies on the ground before him. The redacted contractor, who had been guarding the gate, stopped firing, aware that friendlies had moved in among his targets. Still, Reese sprinted across the open ground behind the now burning truck and past the six dead men, so as not to be in his line of fire. He would sweep the back corner of the perimeter and come in at the rear of the redacted building to ensure that no one was behind their position. He moved past one of the two small staff houses and scanned for any sign of movement. He heard a scuffle behind him and spun quickly to see two figures struggling 15 yards away. He took a step toward them when a white-hot explosion blew him from his feet. Chapter 40. Reese was underwater. It was pitch dark. He put his hand in front of his face but couldn't see anything. He couldn't breathe, but there was no panic, only peace. A tiny light, as if glowing through a pinhole, emerged in the depths below him. He swam toward it, the water thick as jelly. It was like trying to swim in winter clothing. He heard a faint voice that sounded like Lauren's. He swam harder downward toward it. The voice sounded garbled under the water, but became increasingly louder and clearer.
"James? James?"
He swam as hard as he could, the voice morphing from his late wife's voice to one with a tinge of an Eastern European accent. He felt himself floating toward the surface, an unseen force pulling him away from the light. Suddenly the light was blinding. He blinked away from it and turned his head to avoid it.
"James! James, you okay, buddy?"
The red penlight shifted from his eyes to his chest, and he felt a hand moving over his body, searching for wounds. As he regained his senses, he realized that he was on his back, and one of the contractors was administering first aid. He pushed the man's hand away and sat up quickly, reaching around frantically until he found his weapon slung at his side.
"You good?"
"I think so,"
Reese responded in a hoarse tone. The man kneeling in front of him was wearing black Ranger panty running shorts, flip-flops, and a plate carrier. His NODs were pushing upward on his helmet, and his belt-fed MK-46 machine gun was sitting nearby on its bipod, barrel a glowing white.
"You'll be okay, man. I like your outfit," he said, indicating Reese's boxers.
Freddy ran up and knelt beside the two men.
"Reese, you alive?"
"That guy in an S-vest came out of nowhere. I was changing mags and couldn't get on him fast enough. Somebody tackled him right before he blew it."
"Yeah, man, I'm fine." Reese shook his head to clear the cobwebs.
"If you can watch this breach in the wall and make sure no one gets behind us, Brett and I can clear the rest of the place,"
Freddy said, nodding toward the redacted man.
"Check. I'm on it."
The sun rose an hour later, bathing the smoldering compound in the pink radiance of morning. Fires, big and small, were scattered about from the various explosions, and bodies were strewn everywhere. All had been quiet since the last explosion that had almost killed Reese, and they had confirmed that the compound was secure, at least for now. One of the security contractors had been killed in the opening VB-IED blast, while another had been wounded shortly after the incursion began. By Freddy's count, there were at least 23 enemy dead. Reese was cut up and bruised and probably had a concussion, but was fine otherwise. He rose to his feet slowly and walked stiffly toward where the suicide bomber had detonated his vest, examining the grisly scene. Pieces of human flesh and bone were scattered across the blackened ground. When he saw it, he froze. It was a foot, severed at the calf but unbloodied and still wearing a brown leather sandal. He recognized it immediately. It had belonged to Majid, his teacher. The man who had taught him so much about his own beloved religion in hopes of stamping out the darkness within it had died protecting him. Reese knelt and prayed to his own god silently, an act of which he knew Majid would approve. Within an hour of daylight, a 12-man crisis response force from the 10th Special Forces Group was fast-roping into the compound from a pair of hovering MH-60 aircraft, the powerful rotor wash turning the entire area into a dust bowl. They had been working with government forces in nearby Mali when the emergency call went out from the redacted unit on site. They were hours closer than other units of similar capabilities in Italy and Djibouti, and were routed directly to the emergency. Unlike the debacle in Benghazi, they had launched on very little information and headed toward the fight. The multicam-clad special forces men fanned out as soon as they hit the ground, forming a defensive perimeter and deploying a sniper and machine gunner to the roof of the main house. The team's highly capable medic went to work on the wounded former Marine redacted contractor as the unit's commander approached the two SEALs, who were sitting on the tailgate of a pickup. He was 5'6" and stocky, with a face of dark stubble, full tattoo sleeves on both arms poking from below his Krai combat shirt. A 10.5-inch barreled M4 hung across the front of his body armor. He looked too old for his rank, and Reese assumed that he was a fellow enlisted man turned officer.
"I'm Mac, team leader. You guys okay?"
"Thanks for coming, Mac. I'm Freddy."
The exhausted operator shook the army captain's extended hand. Mac turned his gaze to Reese, and his eyes widened.
"I know you. You're James Reese."
"No, I'm not. I get that all the time, though."
"Ah, yeah. Well, let's just say that if you were James Reese, I'd want to shake your hand.
Well, in that case, you'll just have to settle for mine. Reese took the man's hand and shook it warmly.
You need the medic? Mac asked, nodding toward Reese, who looked like he'd bathed in blood.
I think I'm good, just a little rattled from that S-vest.
So what in the hell happened here? What is this place? They told us it was a CIA compound.
It's a training site, Strain responded. They hit us in the middle of the night, breached the wall with VBIEDs in two places. One of the redacted guys was killed immediately and another one was wounded, as you know. He and the other remaining contractor kept the bad guys busy back here while we fought them off the house.
Looks like you guys kicked some ass. Sorry we couldn't get here in time to help.
No worries. It didn't last very long. Redacted took the brunt of it. They hit the wrong end of the compound in force if they were trying to get us. You actually made it here faster than I thought.
You can thank the 160th for that, Mac replied, referring to the Army's 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, which was widely regarded as having the best helicopter pilots in the world.
Any ideas on who they might be? Seems too coordinated for locals, and the gear is almost better than ours.
I have an idea, Reese replied.
Well, my team will run biometrics on them. If they're on any databases, we'll know ASAP.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mac.
I've got to check on my team. Holler if you need anything. We have a perimeter set up and there's a pred on station, so rest easy.
Reese nodded as the Special Forces captain jogged off toward the main house.
You know who they were, don't you, Freddy?
I do, but I can't bring myself to believe it.
They were agency trained, buddy. Someone at Langley wants us dead.
We've trained and outfitted a few different units in this part of the world, Reese. Some of them are not under agency control anymore, but they still have our weapons and haven't forgotten our training.
Is it possible that someone inside doesn't want us to take down Nawaz?
Even crazier, could Nawaz have someone in the CIA? Reese asked.
That doesn't seem possible, but stranger things have happened.
Remember what Hastings told us the night before we left Mo's?
Yeah, I remember, Freddy confirmed.
He told us not to trust the CIA. More specifically, he warned us not to trust the politicians that control the CIA.
Maybe he was right.
I'm sure the redacted is on their way, Freddy said, changing topics and referring to the redacted secret police.
We need to get you out of here. CRF can stay and secure the site while we drive to the embassy. We're obviously compromised.
Roger that. I'll get packed up.
Don't be a tough guy. Why don't you go see the 18 Delta before that shit gets infected, the former SEAL senior chief said, using the military occupational shorthand used to classify Special Forces medics.
I will, Freddy.
Who knew we were here?
It's a short list, and I'm going to find out everyone who was on it.
They were halfway to Redacted when a call came through on the sat phone. Freddy mostly listened, chiming in only occasionally in affirmation, then ended the call.
Change of plans. We're headed to Istanbul.
What's in Istanbul?
It's not what, but who. Mo's in Istanbul, at least that's what the analysts think.
Istanbul, great place to go to ground.
We need to hit the embassy in Redacted to pick up your passport and then we'll head straight to the airfield. They have a clean identity for you and they've wiped your data off the facial recognition databases. You're still technically a wanted man. We don't want some cop in Turkey taking you down.
Just like that?
Just like that, Reese.
Chapter 41. In the spy novels he'd read, the CIA always flew around in private jets, so Reese was a bit disappointed when their ride turned out to be a twin turboprop MC-12W, a military version of the King Air 350ER.
This particular model was set up for electronic surveillance missions and must have been the closest aircraft available. The plane's narrow cabin was packed with what looked to be complicated electronic warfare gear, making accommodations a bit cramped. As professional soldiers, both Reese and Freddy knew that you took sleep when you could and were out within 20 minutes of takeoff. It was 10 p.m. local by the time they touched down at Istanbul Atatürk International, a smaller facility on the European side of the Bosporus Strait. They were waved through passport control thanks to their black diplomatic passports, their gear bags and weapons cases sealed as diplomatic pouches, exempting them from inspection by customs officials. A fresh-faced kid who looked to be in his mid-20s met them just outside the secure area and led them to a nondescript white van in the loading area. Reese guessed that he was the junior man at the local CIA station, but he had the good sense to sit up front and not ask any questions of the shaggy-looking commandos in the back seat. Thanks to the late hour, the ride to the consulate took only 30 minutes. Reese shook his head in amusement when they passed a Burger King just before turning toward the American compound. After a good night's sleep in small but modern rooms on the consulate grounds, Reese and Freddy were guided to the CIA section, which constituted an entire wing of the top floor of the building. Their escort left them in a secure conference room where a coffee mess was set up on the long rectangular table. Reese was pleasantly surprised to see they had both honey and cream at the ready. 5 minutes later, the chief of station breezed into the room holding a tall cup of Starbucks. Kelly Hampton was 45, but could probably pass herself off as being a decade younger. Those who met her professionally were often surprised to learn she was the ranking CIA officer in Turkey. She stood 5'11" and still had the physique from her college days swimming for Princeton. She wore a simple blue pantsuit over a white silk blouse, and her light brown hair was still a bit damp from her shower. A mother of two small children, she carefully juggled her home life with her CIA career, redacted. Reese liked her instantly.
"Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Kelly. Did you get coffee?"
"Yes, ma'am," both men said in unison. "I'm Freddy Strain," the CIA man said, shaking her extended hand across the table. "And this is James Donovan."
"Nice to meet you both," she smiled warmly. "We have a video teleconference set up with Langley, so let's get this thing running."
She used a remote control to operate a large LCD screen on the wall at the end of the room. Within moments, the smiling face of an Asian female who looked like she belonged in a college sorority filled the screen.
"Good morning, guys. I'm Nicole Fan. I'm an analyst at the CTC," she said, referring to the CIA's counterterrorism center. "We have some exciting news. We believe with a high degree of certainty that Mohammed Farouk is in Turkey."
The young analyst spoke with such enthusiasm Reese could tell that she loved her job.
"One of his lieutenants, Adam El-Kader, was spotted on a surveillance camera outside a bank near the Arap Mosque in the Karaköy neighborhood, and he pinged on the NSA's facial recognition database. Our data people dug into the mosque's computers and found a series of donations by a Wasif Hameda, which is a suspected alias of Mohammed. The most recent donation was made last week, so we assess there is a high likelihood that he's still in the area."
"That fits," Freddy responded. "Any idea where he's living? What he's driving, establishments he frequents?"
"I wish I had more on that front, but that's all we know for now. We'll keep working on it. This all popped within the past 48 hours.
"Well, thanks so much for getting it to us so quickly. Anything new on Nawaz?"
"Unfortunately, no. He is notoriously cautious about communicating electronically. We believe all his planning is done in person or via courier. He's learned from watching us target his contemporaries."
"Well, keep us posted. If we are able to make contact with Mohammed, we'd sure like to be able to corroborate anything he tells us about Nawaz via technical means. Otherwise, this is all going to happen based off single-source humint."
"We do have some other interesting information, though," Nicole continued. The Special Forces team uploaded the fingerprints they scanned from the men who attacked your compound in...
Redacted.
We ran them through BATS and APHIS, and it turns out that almost all were members of an Iraqi commando unit. Mohammed Farouk's former commando unit. As you both know, that was a CIA-run program. What you might not know is that when we withdrew from Iraq in 2011, we attempted to keep running them through Iraqi officers we'd recruited during the war, but in all the chaos of the drawdown and withdrawal of forces, we lost control. It's been rumored that they have become a death squad of sorts and hire out as mercenaries if it's approved by their officers and the money is right.
Did I help train any of them? Reese asked.
They ranged from 2007 to 2014 and were all still active on the unit's roster. One set of prints came back as a Captain Salih Daraji. His time overlaps with yours, Mr. Donovan.
Reese nodded, remembering the face he'd last seen covered in blood as he'd pulled his knife from Captain Daraji's brain stem in the dirt of the CIA compound.
So you're saying an active CIA-trained Iraqi commando unit traveled to...
Redacted. To attack a U.S. compound? Freddy asked.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Crazy, huh? Somebody doesn't like you boys very much.
Solid assessment, Freddy acknowledged. You said almost all were part of the stew. Who are the others?
The two suicide bombers were unidentifiable. What parts we could find didn't link to anyone in our databases. We do have a source in Libya who's reported the two recruits being developed as suicide bombers are missing. And get this, one was only 16.
As horrible as that is, it makes sense, Freddy offered. The stew is a direct action focus unit, not fanatical suicide bombers, but they wouldn't hesitate to use someone recruited to wear an S vest to get the job done, or place blame for an operation elsewhere. Thank you for your help, Langley.
No worries. Reach out if you need us.
Nicole smiled warmly as she ended the conference.
She certainly was chipper, Reese said, sipping his coffee.
If this station can support in any way, just let me know, Kelly said.
What do you have on that mosque and neighborhood? Reese asked. Any assets inside?
I'll get you what we have. For now, I'll give you a quick lay of the land. Are you too familiar with the state of affairs here in Turkey?
We'd love a refresher, Freddy answered.
Okay, well, as you may or may not know, Turkey is sliding quickly from a secular nation to an increasingly intolerant Islamic state. They've rediscovered their identity and are begging to flex their muscles. Things were already heading in that direction, but after the attempted coup in 2016, it's gone into overdrive. This is a country with 85,000 mosques, and they're building more every day. The imams are all government employees, so assume that when you step foot inside, everything you say will be reported to the MIT, the National Intelligence Organization. Hostility toward the West, and the U.S. specifically, is snowballing. The U.S. has over 1,000 personnel at Incirlik Air Base.
Redacted.
During the coup attempt, the Turks cut off power and the base was encircled by a mob incited by the government-controlled imams. Not usually how allies act. Ordinarily, I'd be hesitant to put an American into a mosque in this environment, but in this case, your status as a fugitive may be an asset.
James Donovan is a wanted man. That's news to me, Ms. Hampton, Reese said.
I'm sorry, you look so much like someone named James Reese who made the news last year.
Honest mistake.
We'll keep this between us girls. In all seriousness, though, this is an absolute priority mission, so you have our complete support. You can use this conference room as your office, if you like. My extension is 5150. This line is secure, she said, motioning to a phone on a side table as she prepared to leave. If you need to reach out to Langley. And gentlemen, good hunting.
What are you thinking, Reese? Freddie's tone turned all business. I'm wondering just what in the hell is going on here. You got history with that Iraqi unit. Any theories?
I'm thinking Landry.
What do you mean?
Think about it.
He stayed on with that program after I left in 06 and continued to work with Mo and his squadron. Now he's disappeared and the men he trained show up at our door in the middle of the redacted desert. Too much of a coincidence for me.
What was he like? Freddy asked. I never worked with him.
Jules Landry is a shady character, the kind of guy that gives the agency a bad reputation. He was a one-way street. He'd take whatever info you had, but never show you his cards. I never really trusted him. He was a sick bastard, too.
How so?
He'd get a few beers in him and then wander over to the Iraqi side of the compound where the detainees were kept. One night I couldn't sleep and was outside getting a late-night workout in to clear my head. I heard a scream coming from that direction, so I went over to investigate. He was alone in a cell with a detainee he had tied to a chair, naked. He had a knife in one hand and a taser in the other. I yanked him out of there and put him in the dirt. He was drunk, so it wasn't hard. Then I locked him in a cell and called my agency contact at the embassy. I never saw Landry again.
Surprised a guy like that made it through the psych eval.
I'll call the counter-intel guys and see if they have anything on him.
That's a good place to start. In the meantime, we have to figure out how to make contact with Mo.
Within an hour of his request to Langley, Strain had an initial counterintelligence report on Jules Landry emailed to him. Most of the materials were from his personnel file. Strain read them aloud.
Lafayette, Louisiana native, came into the agency as a contractor in 2003 after two deployments to Iraq as a Marine NCO. Assigned to the CIA's Special Tactics Unit, Baghdad, in 2005, and ran the program beginning in 2006. Rotated back and forth to Iraq and stayed on with the program when conventional forces were pulled out in late 2011. Requested emergency leave in June of 2013 and disappeared after his flight landed in Frankfurt. He went to ground and the agency hasn't heard from him since. Passport hasn't been used. He was rumored to be working as a mercenary in Syria, but that was never substantiated.
Nothing about my report that he was torturing prisoners?
Nothing I can see.
That's unbelievable.
Sounds like they just reinserted him into the stew after I left. How does that make any sense?
I don't know, Reese.
Maybe he has someone looking out for him?
Possibly. I'd like to know who that is.
Hey, when did the Syrian civil war start?
Middle of 2011, if I recall, Freddy answered.
And ISIS swept Anbar in early 2014?
Yep, with Mo going missing in December of 2013.
Reese tilted his head back and exhaled, pausing for several seconds.
Who recruited Landry to the CIA?
It doesn't say, but I'm sure I can find out.
There was a knock at the door, and almost immediately the lock clicked open and Kelly Hampton's head poked into the room.
Am I interrupting?
Not at all, please. Freddy responded. She closed the door and took a seat.
Here's what I have on the Arap Mosque. It's actually an old Catholic church that was taken over by the Ottomans. They call it the Arap Mosque because after Spain exiled the Andalusian Arabs in 1492, that's where they settled. Arap means Arab. It's a relatively small mosque that serves the Belu district. One of our local assets worships there. We didn't ask him about Mo because we didn't want to risk tipping him off, but he says that the imam is very moderate. He doesn't think there are any jihadi links with the mosque or its members. It's a western, upscale part of the city, so that's not unusual.
Mo can fit in anywhere, Reese said. He also never struck me as deeply religious, so it sounds like his kind of place. He could go through the motions of looking like a young, progressive Muslim. Let's assume he's living nearby. Any recommendations on how to get noticed in that community?
You'll be noticed, all right. I'd recommend we put you up at the Tom Tom Suites. I know it sounds goofy, but it's the nicest spot in that area. Really modern. It's about a mile from the mosque. We are putting you in as an aspiring novelist doing research on Islam's influence on Turkey. It gives you a reason to be there asking questions and taking notes. Make yourself seen in the hotel bar and the local cafes. My guess is that an operator like him is going to have a local network, and if we're lucky, he'll approach you rather than you having to work your way into the mosque. I know you've been trained, but that's just really risky in my mind. So much can go wrong, especially in this climate.
Freddy turned to Reese. Sounds like we need to get you some new clothes.
May I also suggest a haircut and a beard trim?
Kelly Hampton said with apparent amusement.
Give me your sizes and I'll send someone shopping for you.
Chapter 42. Istanbul, Turkey. August. By evening, they had an initial plan in place and Reese had a new wardrobe. It was a bit contemporary for his taste, but he convinced himself that it was a form of camouflage. Freddy had wandered down to the consulate's detachment of Marines and located a lance corporal who served as the de facto barber for the security element. Nearly every military unit had someone who made a few extra bucks cutting hair. Reese was a bit nervous given the high and tight standards of the Corps, but the kid from Chicago did a great job. Reese emerged looking less like a biblical character and more like a dapper city dweller with collar-length hair and a neatly trimmed beard.
You look like a hipster, was Freddy's only comment.
The next morning, Reese traded his faded T-shirt for a fitted blue Oxford along with dark jeans, a tan linen sport coat, and brown leather boots. The remainder of his new wardrobe went into a nylon duffel along with some of his casual clothing and workout gear. A tan messenger bag contained various smaller items, including spare magazines and a suppressor for the SIG 365 concealed inside his waistband. A newly issued iPhone was equipped with various useful apps along with an extremely sophisticated VPN, which made his communications as secure as the NSA could make them. When he climbed into the back of the Mercedes SUV alongside Freddy in the underground parking garage, he made the conscious mental shift from James Reese, former SEAL commando and CIA contractor, to James Donovan, aspiring novelist. The driver, a local CIA case officer, took a circuitous route from the consulate to the Geratepe metro station, making frequent turns to ensure that they weren't being followed. Freddy bid Reese good luck as the SUV approached the curb.
I'll see you when I see you.
He rode down the escalator into the modern subway station and made a show of examining the arrival and departure screens. He pulled his phone from his pocket and pretended to read a text message before taking the up escalator back to the street level among a gaggle of arriving passengers. A line of four yellow Hyundai taxis sat outside the station's entrance, and Reese motioned for the lead driver to open his trunk. Stowing his duffel inside, he retained the smaller bag, showing the driver a printed reservation for the TomTom Suites. This was Reese's first time seeing Istanbul's grandeur in daylight. The historic city of 17 million residents had been the seat of both the Byzantine and Ottoman empires, bridging the continents and thereby connecting the world. Their route took them from the modern neighborhood with towering high-rises south until they turned to parallel the Bosphorus, connecting the Black Sea to the north with the Sea of Marmara to the south. This side of the water was Europe, the other, Asia. They passed an arena on their right and massive cruise ship terminals on their left. Reese craned his neck like an excited tourist, which, fortunately for him, fit his cover story. After a scenic 20-minute drive, the cab stopped in front of an elegant white structure with black shutters. The TomTom Suites, which was built into the steep slope of the hill on which it was constructed, looked more Dutch than Mediterranean in its architecture, and reminded Reese of Cape Town. A young, uniform-clad bellman opened the cab door and welcomed Reese to the property. Reese made a show of paying the driver in U.S. bills, leaving a hefty tip.
The man smiled and thanked Reese in vastly improved English, and, seeing the wad of cash, the bellman's eyes lit up too. He scurried to the open trunk to retrieve Reese's luggage and led him through the hotel's glass-canopied entrance. He stood aside as Reese approached the front desk, handing him a U.S. $20 bill.
There are a few better ways to attract attention than by throwing money around.
The hotel staff were efficient and courteous, obviously pleased by the 10-day reservation. When asked if he needed assistance with his bags, he almost spit out his default, "No thank you," but decided that a guy like James Donovan wouldn't mind someone carrying his luggage for him. Another $20 ensured that the staff would remain interested. The spacious room was on the third floor with an amazing view of tiled rooftops, minaret towers, and the churning waters of the Bosphorus. The parquet wooden floors stretched the length of the suite, with a living area arranged at the foot of the king-sized bed. A large, impressionistic painting that appeared to depict the city's skyline hung above the headboard, and, through the sliding glass wall that separated it from the living area, he could see that the bathroom was covered in dappled white marble from floor to ceiling. Reese much preferred his humble hooch in Mozambique. The SEAL-turned-intelligence operative took a small device from his messenger bag that was disguised to look like an external hard drive. It was, in fact, a counter-surveillance device designed to detect hidden listening devices and cameras. There was no reason to suspect that he was under surveillance, government or otherwise, but one didn't make assumptions in this line of work. After sweeping the room without any indication of an active bug, Reese returned the device to his bag. He entered the 9-digit passcode into his iPhone and sent Freddy a text message. "In room 307, view to the southeast. All good." Within 30 seconds, his phone vibrated.
"Good copy. 5 minutes out if you need me."
Freddy and the case officer who had driven them from the consulate were set up in a safe house several blocks to the northeast. From their position, they could act as backup in case Reese ran into trouble and could also feed him information as it came in from local sources and from the various information-gathering assets at the U.S. government's disposal. Their position was close enough to respond in case of an emergency, but far away enough so as not to arouse suspicion. It was time to rely on the time-honored attribute for which snipers were known: patience. Chapter 43. The Arap Mosque sits in a cluttered neighborhood near the river, with multi-story buildings of assorted vintages lining narrow streets. A wider, more modern four-lane thoroughfare runs 2 blocks to the west, with a parking lane separated by a concrete curb in front of a shopping area that is more Middle Eastern than European. An undeveloped lot sat between 2 apartment buildings and served as a park for the local residents. A direct path to the mosque would pass right through it. A glade of green grass added some color, and several towering trees provided shade from the midday sun. At 11 o'clock a.m., Reese found a bench facing the four-lane road, removed his sunglasses, and opened a copy of the Times of London. Foot traffic was light, as most of the residents of this working-class neighborhood were busy working at this hour. A mother scrolled through her smartphone as her 3-year-old daughter played nearby. The child quickly turned her interest to Reese, staring at him curiously through big brown eyes. He began to play peekaboo with his newspaper, her soft giggles evolving into belly laughs as the duration of his hides lengthened. The child's laughter brought a smile to his face, but sadness to his heart, as he thought of his own daughter, who had never tired of playing the game.
"Focus, Reese."
By 11:30 a.m., the volume of traffic increased as men began making their way toward Jumu'ah. The oldest men arrived first. Some traditions seemed to transcend culture. As the noon hour approached, the crowds grew thicker and the worshippers younger. The men ranged from business suit-clad professionals to blue-collar workers in more modest dress.
They converged on the steps of the mosque and made their way inside.
Nothing out of the ordinary.
An hour later, the doors opened and the worshippers descended the steps, returning to the jobs and families awaiting them. Rhys stayed seated for another 30 minutes before heading back to the hotel. He spent the afternoon reading and rereading everything that the agency had provided him on Mohammed, including the reports of all his unit's operations. Using an agency VPN developed by a company called Seven Tunnels, he linked to a folder on Dropbox and accessed a seemingly benign music file hidden among thousands of similar files. Just as Freddy had trained him to do in Redacted, he used a Veracrypt encrypted partition hidden within the music file and entered a 26-character password. Nothing was ever downloaded to his computer. Looking over the operations orders and after-action reports from the 10 months that Rhys had worked with Mo and his special tactics unit brought back a flood of memories. Their operations had taken place at the height of the insurgency, in some of the worst neighborhoods in Baghdad. Working in conjunction with and alongside Allied Special Operations units, Mo's STU team played a critical role in capturing high-value individuals and rapidly exploiting intelligence to dismantle enemy networks. They had the added benefit of being an entirely Iraqi unit, which gave them some of the best tactical-level intelligence in theater. They also worked for the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior, which put the fear of Allah into those they captured. Iraq's MOI did not give the Geneva and Hague conventions the same weight as their American allies. When Rhys returned to the United States and the liaison role transitioned completely to Jules Landry, the scope of the operations shifted. Retaliation seemed to be the motive rather than counterinsurgency. Why would the CIA have kept Landry on after Rhys's report on his behavior in Iraq? In Rhys's estimation, Landry was not a stable individual and had no business working sensitive intelligence operations. Mo had been the one Iraqi commander who stood head and shoulders above his peers. He excelled in both the planning and tactical execution of direct action missions, spoke English almost fluently, and had the trust of both his men and the senior leadership of the MOI. After Mo's disappearance, the references to his existence became few and far between, all unconfirmed. A mention of one of his aliases on an intercepted phone call emanating from Syria, possible sightings in Greece, and, of course, the intel that had brought Rhys to Turkey. The only concrete proof that Mo had left Iraq alive was the photo taken in Italy that Freddy had shown him back in Africa. Are we chasing a ghost? A week had passed, and the routine was beginning to wear on him. At least the hotel had a gym where Rhys could crank out some brutal CrossFit and Jim Jones workouts. Each day he followed the same pattern to make it easy for anyone wishing to make contact. He'd wake up, work out, and have breakfast, taking his time to read the paper as he finished his coffee. Then it was a leisurely stroll along the river, eventually ending up outside the Arap Mosque. Still nothing. He wanted to avoid entering the mosque and having to use Majid's lessons. He wasn't sure he could pull it off even if he was going in under the guise of an author doing research for a new novel. He'd give it one more day. If no one made contact with him by then, he'd go the mosque route. At 10 to noon, he saw them. 3 men crossing the road toward the park, their heads on swivels. Predators. 2 of the men appeared to be in their late 20s, while the third was closer to Rhys's age. They each had the broad shoulders of athletes, all wore sunglasses, expensive leather boots, and light jackets. They didn't wear rank or unit insignia, but to Rhys's trained eye, it was as if they were in uniform. Rhys lowered the newspaper to his lap and stared directly at them as they approached. The older man noticed him as soon as he stepped onto the sidewalk, and by the time they were within 20 yards of the bench, all 3 were staring holes in him.
The posture of the younger men changed from vigilant to combative as they neared Reese's position, chests thrust upward, a swagger in their step, heads held high. Their physical behavior sent a primordial message. This was their territory, and he was an intruder.
Could this be Moe's security detail?
Reese made sure to hold their stares until they walked completely past him.
Message sent.
Reese lingered until quarter past noon to ensure that Moe wasn't coming, and then walked toward the front of the mosque on his way back to the hotel, noticing a pair of 10-year-old boys tailing him from a block behind.
Perfect.
He kept a slow and easy pace to ensure they were able to follow him. Back in his room, Reese rechecked for listening devices before calling Freddy at the safe house. He answered immediately.
How'd it go?
It went. Three guys that looked like they could have been extras in a Chuck Norris movie walked right past me, eyeballing me the whole way. They had a couple of kids follow me home, so I think we set the hook.
That's great. Just be careful. Hopefully they are Moe's guys and not just some local thugs.
They looked former military. I'll be careful.
Good. I've got some news on Landry. A buddy in counterintelligence called and gave me some intel from their initial report. It seems as though young Mr. Landry had a criminal record that the agency didn't know about when they hired him. Besides a couple of simple battery-type arrests as a juvenile, he was arrested for rape during his senior year of high school. Somehow, the case went away. I'm guessing he cut a deal to join the Marines. The counterintelligence division and the IG's office are still looking into it, but the odd part is that someone made it disappear during his screening. It doesn't surprise me that he's a scumbag, but it is weird that he got in the door with that kind of record. See if you can find out who recruited him and who signed off on his background.
I'm already on it.
Thanks.
I'll hit you up at our next comm window. Reese cut the call and looked out his window over the city. Moe was out there somewhere, one of the most highly trained covert operatives in the world. He had become a terrorist, and somehow Landry was involved. Not long ago, they had all depended on one another to survive in battle. Reese couldn't help but think that the next time they met up, not all of them would be walking away.
Chapter 44. How would Moe make contact?
Reese knew the CIA had given him some of the same training they give the case officers, but Reese's experience with Moe and his unit in Iraq had been of a more kinetic nature. Reese still had a hard time believing that the Iraqi major he'd trusted with his life was now a terrorist, targeting the same Western nations he had fought alongside in the cradle of civilization. Reese needed to get some air. The coffee bar downstairs had proven to be excellent, so he ordered a to-go cup of their lightest roast. After doctoring it with milk and honey, he nodded to the bellman, who held the door for him as he walked out into the afternoon sunshine. The coffee was too hot to drink, so Reese removed the plastic lid and blew on it as he walked along the steep uphill path. With his subconscious mind occupied by the mountain of intelligence documents he'd read, and his conscious focus on the coffee, Reese noticed and then dismissed the maintenance worker clad in bright coveralls as he walked past him. Mistake. 2 seconds later, he heard the pop of the compressed nitrogen and immediately felt the sting of the metal barbs that penetrated his shirt and embedded themselves into the muscle of his upper back. His limbs instantaneously contracted and cramped, as 2,000 volts of electricity surged into his body, dropping him to the sidewalk. His entire body in taut agony, in addition to being burned by the scalding hot coffee. The pain ended nearly as quickly as it began, and he found himself floating above the sidewalk, unable to move his limbs. As his chest hit the floorboard of the Transit Connect delivery van, he realized that he'd been flex-cuffed at both his wrists and ankles. A pillowcase was pulled over his head as the door slid to a close. In a moment of out-of-body clarity,
he marveled at how quickly his abductors had planned and executed this operation. It was hot inside the van, and the floor smelled of grease and oil, mixing with the strong odor of the coffee that soaked his shirt. Reese lay still, conserving his energy in case it became necessary to run or fight later, though the objective of the mission was to do neither. Strong hands frisked him from head to toe, covering every inch of his body with no regard for modesty. His subcompact SIG, spare magazine, knife, shoes, and iPhone were taken from him. He assumed that the phone was being placed inside a container that would prevent his location from being tracked. There was no talking among his captors, which made it nearly impossible for him to determine their exact numbers. The driver didn't speed or drive erratically. Instead, he navigated the city's streets as part of the normal flow of traffic, making frequent turns. These men were pros. After what seemed like an hour, but was probably half that, the van stopped. The driver turned off the diesel motor and engaged the parking brake. He heard the sound of chains from outside the van, and a steel service door rolled downward on its tracks. They'd pulled into a garage or warehouse based on the echo of voices in what sounded like Arabic. The van door slid open quickly, and what felt like three men dragged him out by his ankles and stood him upright, his stockinged feet landing on the cold concrete floor. Some type of motor hummed in the background. "Walk," a voice from behind him said in accented English. One man held each arm, and a third had him by the top of the head, guiding him forward and away from the direction of the door. He walked 20 paces before his feet felt the threshold of a door and then thin carpeting. After a few more steps, he could hear the sound of a chair being dragged across the carpet behind him. "Sit." Footsteps shuffled away, and he heard the door shut behind him. He slowed his breathing, settled his heart rate, and concentrated on the plastic restraints that bound his wrists in front of him. In a move that he and his teammates had practiced dozens of times in various SEER courses, Reese pushed his arms up and away from his body, then snapped them down across his abdomen. The plastic gave way to freedom. He rubbed his wrists as the blood rushed into his tingling hands and pulled the cloth away from his head. The room was dark. It was a small office, the kind attached to industrial spaces, with a desk, filing cabinets, and dusty stacks of books and papers on the floor. 10 feet away, he saw a dark couch against the wall, and a shot of adrenaline shot through his body as his brain registered a human figure seated on it. As he rose to his still restrained feet, a flash of light illuminated the room. The flame burned brightly, and as the man inhaled on his cigarette, the light glowed against his bearded face.
"Mo!" Reese shouted.
"James Reese. What on earth are you doing here, my friend?"
Mo said, as he exhaled a cloud of gray smoke and extinguished his lighter. He turned on a lamp, and Reese saw him clearly for the first time. Dashing as ever, Mo's longish black hair was slicked back, his beard precisely cropped, and his clothing impeccable. He stowed the silver lighter into the pocket of his tailored sport coat, rose from his chair, and embraced Reese in a strong hug. Then, drawing an automatic knife from the pocket of his jeans, he dropped to one knee and swiftly cut the plastic binding from Reese's ankles.
"Sit down, sit down,"
Mo motioned Reese back into his chair as he turned back toward the couch.
"Sorry about the way my men treated you, but I had to make sure it was really you."
"Well, you could have just called my room." "No worries, though. No permanent damage, except for the coffee stains."
"I have heard so much, Reese. I am so sorry for the loss of your family. May God watch over them. To lose loved ones in wartime is one thing, but to have the peace of one's home shattered is another altogether. I have some experience there, if you recall."
"I do. Thanks, Mo," Reese said, feeling the gut-wrenching pain at the thought of his wife and little girl riddled with bullets on the floor of their home.
"Why did you come to Istanbul?" The way you put yourself directly in my sights, my guess is you came here to find me. I can help you, but if you are looking to hide, there are better places, my friend. The American intelligence services will find you here. You should not have come. I'm not on the run anymore, Mo. The government made me a deal. Why in the world would they do that? Because they needed me to find you.
Mo's calm and composed demeanor changed perceptibly. He shifted forward with a puzzled look on his face.
What do you mean by that? They know exactly how to find me.
Now it was Reese's turn to look puzzled.
What are you talking about, Mo? You're running a terrorist cell for Amin Nawaz. You're a wanted man with a price on your head.
Reese, you don't understand. I work for the CIA. Remember Jules Landry? He's been my handler for years.
Chapter 45. Tom Tom Sweets, Istanbul, Turkey. Reese, where in the hell have you been? We lost track of you.
I'm safe, Freddy. He made contact. We need to talk. ASAP, Reese responded. Reese was back in his hotel room, personal possessions returned, and none the worse for wear.
Roger that. How do you want to do it?
I'm blown here, so it doesn't matter. I'll get cleaned up, grab my gear, and catch a ride back to the consulate. Meet you back there in an hour or so.
If you're blown, we'll just pick you up.
Check. Give me 15.
You got it.
Reese changed and packed his bags. There was no sense staying at the hotel any longer. He was exposed here, and though he trusted Mo, he couldn't know whether someone in Mo's private army was playing both sides. An American intelligence officer would be a fat target to a jihadi looking to help the cause. The agency SUV was idling at the curb when Reese walked through the hotel's front door, the anxious bellman trailing behind him. Reese loaded his own bags and nodded to the confused employee as he handed him a 20 and climbed into the back seat. Freddy turned around in his seat with an extremely worried expression on his face.
You okay, buddy?
Well, I can't exactly claim to be a super spy. Mo's guys tased me and threw me into a van while I was sipping a latte.
That would never have happened to Mitch Rapp or Scott Harvath.
Hey, man, I'm just a vanilla frogman.
I think the Hartleys would disagree, if they were still around. You want to give me the download?
Let me have a minute to stew on it. I think I have an idea.
I don't know why that makes me nervous, Freddy replied with a shake of his head.
The case officer drove directly to the consulate, and within a half hour they were inside a secure conference room. Reese began to go through the details of the meeting while Freddy scribbled notes on a yellow legal pad. Mo thinks he's still working for the agency. He admitted to coordinating the mortar attack on the British paras and taking out the NATO commander, but he swears he was following our orders.
Who gave him the orders?
You ready for this? Reese paused for effect. Jules Landry. He's been handling Mo this entire time, first in Syria, then in Europe.
You're shitting me, Freddy said in disbelief.
Nope.
And you believe him?
He was genuinely shocked when I told him Landry had gone rogue. I could tell he felt betrayed. Remember, I've been in combat with Mo. We've trusted each other with our lives. I don't think he'd lie to me. Why would the CIA be running a pseudo-terrorist to hit our allies? That doesn't make any sense.
I know, Reese said.
He's been thinking that Landry was running him against Nawaz, getting him close, having him gather intel, and that Landry gave him CIA-approved targets to hit in order to prove his worth to Nawaz. Kind of like how the DEA assets operate in the cartels. They pass information to their DEA handler, who lets the majority of drug shipments continue into the U.S. to not blow their assets cover as they continue to move up in the organization. Same thing here.
Jesus.
And think about where he comes from. Iraq. He grew up under Saddam Hussein, who did the unspeakable to keep his people living in fear and in line. He told me Landry was specific with him about hitting military targets.
Mo actually thought the supporting effort was to keep our allies involved in the GWOT and ensure they had the public support to do so. He admitted to organizing the attack on the Paras, and he took out General Alexander with the drone himself, just like the CIA taught him.
What about the Christmas attack in England?
Swears he had nothing to do with it.
He said he'd only hit military targets, and again, I actually believe him.
He knows that Nawaz has multiple independence cells, but doesn't know specifics. He was working his way up, but he wasn't there yet. That's why he believed that Landry was running him for the CIA. It's actually quite genius.
Yeah, but to what end?
There is something we're missing. Why would Landry go rogue and run a former STU commando inside ISIS in Europe? He's not employed by the CIA anymore. What's his endgame?
I don't know, Freddy.
Landry isn't bright enough to mastermind anything. He's not a thinker. Whatever he's doing, he's in it for the money or the rush.
I'll pass all that to CIA and have them keep digging on Landry. Past associates, bank accounts, aliases. We'll catch a break eventually.
Does Mo know where Nawaz is hiding?
He said he moves constantly, but that he can lead us to him.
Wait, he agreed just like that? Freddy asked dubiously.
Not exactly.
What do you mean, Reese?
He'll lead us to Nawaz, but only if we give him a shot at Landry.
A shot? Like to kill him?
I'm sure he'd like to, but he wants answers.
I would, too.
Okay, let me talk to the bosses, but even if they agree, we are going to have to bring Mo in. We don't have a choice, Reese. He's a terrorist, whether he was being run by a rogue CIA agent or not.
I have another idea. Just hear me out on this. You ever hear of the Celis Scouts?
The Rhodesian guys with the FALs and the nuthugger shorts? Yeah, I've heard of them.
Did you spend too much time in Mozambique? What in the hell do they have to do with this?
Reese detailed his plan, and Freddy gave it the critical review that his position demanded. In the end, Reese was able to counter each of his friend's well-directed arguments. Now, it was a matter of selling it to the decision-makers back at Langley.
Chapter 46. Burgas, Bulgaria. September. Andrenov had arranged a French passport for Landry, which made sense given his heritage and reasonably good, though accented, command of the language. He couldn't pass for French in France, but he had no intention of going there. He didn't stay anywhere too long these days, but he needed to be within reasonable proximity of his asset, so southern Bulgaria was ideal. The Grand Hotel was nice, cheap, and right on the Black Sea coast. Landry spent most of his days working out in the hotel gym to maintain his bodybuilder's physique and to sweat out the sins of the previous evening. While most operators had adopted more functional fitness regimes over the past decade, Landry's vanity kept him focused on training individual muscle groups in isolation. Those workouts and a healthy supply of anabolic steroids kept him looking like a heavily tattooed version of a 1980s action movie hero. Too bad it was too cold to lie out by the pool. Landry loved the looks that the wives of the pot-bellied rich men gave him as he strolled the deck in nothing but a small swimsuit. He'd bedded more than a few when they went upstairs to freshen up while their husbands lazed drunkenly in their lawn chairs. There were no such treats available this evening, as it was the slow season. There wasn't much to do here but work out and drink in the clubs, but lately the booze hadn't been enough. The bartender had a source, and soon Landry was adding cocaine to the mix. It took sleeping pills, Xanax, or opiates to come down from the blow in the early morning hours, sometimes all three, and marijuana to take the edge off when the new day came. Jules Landry had found himself in a cycle of stimulants, depressants, benzodiazepines and sedatives, catalyzed by excessive testosterone levels and a level of alcohol consumption that would have been a problem all by itself. He may have looked like an inked Adonis to the women on the pool deck, but inside he was a mess. The post-dinner hour found Landry drinking in the hotel bar. He'd done a bump of coke after a shower and was three vodkas deep, which meant he was at the peak of his chemically assisted relative normalcy. He'd done arms today, and his biceps were pumped with blood. His black t-shirt clung tightly to them. He rolled his right wrist over and admired the vascularity of his forearm before doing the same on his left side. He looked good. He felt good. There was only one thing missing, and he was certain the bartender could arrange it. She arrived an hour later. She was cute. Hot, actually. She had long, straight, jet-black hair that hung down to her mid-back, a decent face, and a body that looked to be flawless. She reminded him a little bit of a girl back home. Her long legs looked great in tight black leather pants, and when she removed her faux fur coat, her glittery gold halter top rode up and exposed a six-pack of abdominal muscles. Her breasts were obviously enhanced, but she hadn't made the mistake of going too big with them. Yeah, she would do for sure. She spoke no French and only a little English. They weren't going to do much talking anyway.
"I am Darina,"
she said, extending her hand.
"Jules,"
he responded, amused by the formality of the introduction. The bartender brought her some type of vodka drink in a tall glass, and Landry reached out his hand with two pills in the palm.
"What is?"
she questioned.
"Ecstasy."
"What?"
"Ecstasy. You know, ecstasy?" Landry said as he feigned dance moves with his fists up.
"Ah, yes."
She took a tablet from Landry's hand and popped it onto her tongue, washing it down with her drink. Landry swallowed the other pill. By the time the MDMA kicked in, both had downed two more drinks, and Landry motioned to her to follow him upstairs. She asked for the money as soon as they entered the large suite, and Landry handed her a stack of 100-euro notes. Darina excused herself and disappeared into the bathroom to get herself ready. Jules made them each a drink from the bottle he'd brought from the bar and snorted a fat line of cocaine. He heard the toilet flush and then the click of the bathroom door opening. He pulled off his shirt and sat on the bed, holding his drink and waiting anxiously for what would come next. Darina walked seductively into the room, wearing only her black thong panties and high heels. Her body was even better than he thought it would be. He motioned to the nightstand where her drink sat next to several more lines of cocaine. She skipped the drink and went for the powder. She climbed onto the bed and straddled the muscle-bound man who owned her for the next few hours. Minutes later, they were both naked and he was doing another line of blow, this time off the small of her back. Landry was in heaven. Landry's head pounded. The sun was beating through the windows. He'd forgotten to close the curtains in all of last night's excitement.
What time was it?
He rolled over and pulled a second pillow over his head, trying to go back to sleep. His foot slid to the right and he felt something solid on the other side of the sheet.
Is she still here?
He took the pillow from his head and rolled over far enough to see a nude female lying face down, her head toward the footboard of the bed. Something about her didn't look right. Landry kicked her in the thigh in the hopes she would wake up, gather her things, and head out. Nothing. He kicked her again a little harder.
"Get the fuck out,"
he said, kicking her a bit harder with each word. Instead of responding, she slowly slid off the bed and slumped onto the floor. Landry squeezed his eyes together in an attempt to quiet his pounding head. He reached down and touched her arm. Her pale body was unnaturally cool. He rolled her over and brushed her tangled mess of dark hair out of the way, exposing a large bruise on her cheek. Her eyes were wide open and lifeless. A path of dried blood led from her nose to her upper lip. He leaned in closer and saw that she had swollen purple marks on her fragile throat. Instead of revulsion or horror, Landry looked at her in curiosity, trying to remember the events of the previous evening. He'd hit her, but it was just with an open hand. And he'd choked her, he recalled that. Her bulging eyes had filled with fear as he continued to fuck her. He liked that, being inside a prostitute as he took her life. Luckily, shithole countries the world over were filled with young girls for him to punish. He was upset with himself, though, not that he'd killed an innocent woman, but that he couldn't remember how he'd killed her. He'd cheated himself out of that pleasure. Landry took a moment to admire what he could see of her breasts and abs before leaning over the nightstand to do the last line of cocaine. Then he grabbed her under the arms and positioned her on the bed for one last dance with the devil. Chapter 47. CIA Station, Istanbul, Turkey, September. Freddie and Reese went over the pitch several times to ensure that they'd covered all the angles. Freddie knew the internal politics of the agency well enough to realize that their concept had a better chance of gaining approval coming from him rather than Reese. To many back at Langley, Reese was a murderous loose cannon whose only use was his relationship with Moe. This needed to be about the operation. Reese excused himself from the room when the time arrived for Freddie's video teleconference with his superiors back in Northern Virginia. Victor Rodriguez, a former Army Special Forces officer and current head of the Central Intelligence Agency's Special Operations Group, appeared on the screen, joined by the agency's Deputy Director of the National Clandestine Service, Janice Motley. The tailored blue suits worn by both Rodriguez and Motley and the frosted glass interior of the Langley skiff were in sharp contrast to the shaggy-haired and polo-clad SEAL in the Spartan conference room in Istanbul. At least he'd taken off his ball cap. Despite climbing the ranks at the agency, Rodriguez hadn't forgotten where he'd come from and could be counted on to watch the backs of his men in the field. Motley was an unknown quantity among the spies and trigger pullers whom she oversaw in her new role. Her background as the lead staff attorney for the Senate Intelligence Committee didn't exactly fill the operatives with hope when it came to her view of paramilitary work.
"Mr. Strain, good to hear from you. Nice work in..."
Redacted, Rodriguez began.
"Let me introduce you to Deputy Director Janice Motley."
"Pleasure to meet you, ma'am.
I appreciate both of you making time on such short notice."
"We have some extremely time-sensitive intel that needs attention," Freddie said, putting on his most charming smile as he transitioned from covert operator to salesman.
"Please go on, Mr. Strain."
Motley clearly wasn't in the mood for pleasantries.
"Yes, ma'am. As you both know, we successfully recruited James Reese and brought him in to attempt to make contact with Mohammed Farouk, a former Iraqi Special Operations Commander who worked with Commander Reese back during OIF.
"We are well aware of that, Mr. Strain, and you should know that decision was made over my objection," Motley added.
"Understood, ma'am. Earlier today, James Reese made contact with Farouk, who acknowledged his role in planning the attacks on the Colchester garrison in England and the assassination of General Alexander in Brussels. He denied any role in the Christmas attack in Kingston, but did say that Amin Nawaz operates multiple independent cells that do not have